You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
The essence of TED is that everyone has a message. Everyone has something to communicate. Everyone has a story.
There's communication in every species, but what there isn't in any other species is the ability to build concepts that can then be shared and transferred into other brains, and so that we can all build up these worldviews that change our behavior. There are very few things that people can do by themselves. Almost everything that's worthwhile doing has to be done by multiple people with a shared vision. What our brains notice are things that are different, and so that puts constant pressure on innovating and on finding a way to surprise people. If a speaker shows a bit of vulnerability, shows a bit of humanity, shows you why what you're about to hear actually matters. It's going to be interesting. You know, this is a problem I've been thinking about my whole life, and people don't normally know it. If you can make people want to open the door and make them curious, then suddenly they will really pay attention. What I say in the book is you can't push knowledge into a brain. You know, it has to be pulled in.
Oh my God, I am so excited for this new sponsor, Indochino. Before Indochino, I only had three outfits, but finally I got rid of one and replaced it with a suit from Indochino because they made me fall in love with the feeling of wearing a made-to-measure suit. Pick your fabric, choose your customizations, submit your measurements, and this week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $379 at Indochino.com when entering James at checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit. Plus, shipping is free. That's Indochino.com, promo code James for any premium suit for just $379 and free shipping. Incredible deal for a suit that will fit you better than anything off the rack ever could.
And I know this for sure. Chris Anderson, I don't know how to describe it. You wouldn't quite call yourself the owner of the TED Talks, right? You're kind of like the chief of the TED Talks, the empire of TED, where thousands and thousands of people speak on important, relevant topics every year. There's like, 2 billion views a year on the videos of these TED Talks, or close to 2 billion. And you've also written what I consider to be the seminal guide on public speaking. I always forget the subtitle.
Official guide. How about that? The official guide to public speaking.
The official guide to public speaking. Thank you. I can never, my audience knows this, I never can remember the subtitle of any book.
Yes, subtitles, hard, definitely. I never remember people's names, for what it's worth. So,
well, you
which is a terrible thing to have in.
But I will tell you why. It's because you meet 20,000 people a year, or a million people a year, and the human brain is kind of meant to meet 30 people.
Yeah. Even when I met 30 people, I only remembered 7 of their names, though. I'm just bad at it.
Okay. Well, I'm recognizable. If I bump into you in the street, like, you're going to say at least, oh, James, remember that.
Either that or, oh, Malcolm. No.
I've been accused of that, by the way.
Yeah.
But that's another story. But I just want to add, you've done so many things. You know, I used to read back in the 90s, Business 2.0, a magazine you started. You had a magazine empire. It's the sort of capital in one way or the other that you gained from that, both in terms of reputation, money, however you want to put it. You ended up buying the TED Talks from Richard Werman, who had started them, and you expanded it just in every way, with, you know, thanks to, in part to YouTube and videos, but also with the TEDx. And the TED Talks are really the place to go for knowledge, education. I encourage my daughters to go watch TED Talks instead of going to college. They don't listen to me.
Uh-oh.
they don't listen to me.
Yeah.
I've literally offered my daughter, when I saw the bill for a college tuition, I literally said to her, I will take this exact amount of cash, just give it to you, and we have to watch TED Talks every morning just for 1 to 2 hours. And then you can do whatever you want for the rest of the day. We don't even have to talk about them. And she has so far refused me.
Wait, so your daughter turned down tens of thousands of dollars so that she didn't have to watch TED Talks?
Exactly.
I have not heard that before. That is bad.
Well, no, but then the next step I said is, okay, back off from that. I will give you the same amount of money and we could just watch a movie every day, any movie you want. First thing in the morning, we watch a movie. And she has so far backed away from that. Wow. Now, I still have time. She hasn't started college yet. I make her an offer a day. But I think she's getting so used to saying no to me that it's having less and less effectiveness.
Well, maybe we could do a great joint experiment here and see whether that type of knowledge actually works. It would be a very bold experiment by you.
well, right now though, she's refusing me. So I don't know. I need to find a new, someone who's a willing recipient. It's almost like I want to take an unwilling recipient of this, the Altucher Fellowship, as I call it, and my daughter being the unwilling recipient, and seeing if it changed her life, as I believe it would, in a much more impactful way than a kind of standardized college education. But I don't know if I'll find this out.
Wow. Well, thank you for the welcome. It's very, very nice to be here. And yeah, I'm not the owner of TED. The reason that is true is because it's owned by a nonprofit, which I set up. So when I took it over, I bought it actually with a foundation, not personally. And that turned out to be a really cool thing. It turned out to have a really great outcome. It's actually one of the keys as to why TED has grown since then. But I am the lucky person who gets to kind of lead the team that runs TED. And it's been a very, 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 very fun job over the last 17 years.
I mean, I probably watch TED Talks, I can't say every day because some days are busier than others, but probably several times a week. There's so many interesting topics. How many talks are cataloged now between TED and TEDx?
Oh, combined, there's more than 100,000 now. Most of those are TEDx talks on YouTube.
Right.
On the official, on TED.com, there's about 2,500, of which about 500 are TEDx talks. The rest have been recorded at TED conferences. A lot of people don't know the difference between the two, but the X means self-organized. It's a TEDx event is a self-organized event where we've given someone a free license to go and do the hard work of booking a theater, recruiting people, booking speakers, putting on a show under the TED format and using certain sort of guidelines. We try and help them make it as good as it can, but they do the work. And so that's often the public face of TED. There are 10 of those events every day now, somewhere in the world. And so that's its whole amazing story. But we don't directly like control that. We have encouraged that, allowed that, and it's sort of allowed 1,000 flowers to bloom in different cities and so on.
Well, I think it's a great thing, and I commend you on it, because I think the organizers of a lot of these TEDx conferences, many of whom I either know or I've met or I've been asked to speak at a lot of TEDx conferences, they are very happy with the TED brand on them, and I think that helps them attract speakers, and I think they take it very seriously, and your guidelines on public speaking, they take extremely seriously.
Well, that's cool. I mean, it's amazing because they're held in everywhere from the Sydney Opera House. Well, actually, TEDx Sydney has now outgrown the Sydney Opera House. They now have like 4,000 or 5,000 people in an even bigger venue. But then it's right down to a TEDx event in a jail or in a slum somewhere, or in cities like Kabul and Baghdad and so forth. I mean, it's amazing to see it flourish like that. And I have employed at TED, I've got 16 people who oversee that program. Mm. And between them, they somehow are responsible now for 3,500 events.
That's amazing.
It's great leverage on, like, it's just an amazing model there that it's been thrilling to see take off.
Oh my gosh, there's kind of like 27 directions I want to go. But following the cues from your great book on public speaking, I do want to do a through line, which is essentially the kind of essence of TED is that you bring out the great public speaker, but really bottled up inside everyone. Everyone has a message. Everyone has something to communicate. Everyone has a story. And the TED conferences and the TEDx conferences help people bring out that story. And you describe it really eloquently in your book. And I'll destroy this analogy a little bit, but you almost make it seem like it's a magic trick. Like somebody has a passionate vision in their brain and they need to transmit it to the 500 sitting people in the audience. And the only way they're able to do that is essentially with their voice and movements and whatever else they do on stage. So it's this kind of like brain ESP trick, almost the way you describe it in the book. And then the book itself is great because you are just hardcore. You say, I, as the reader, get the impression you, after seeing thousands of talks, and good talks and bad talks and media, all ranges of talks. And plus you get the analysis, oh, well, this talk got a 10 million views and this talk got zero views. So you get statistical analysis too. You're able to say, okay, here's what I've isolated out as good pieces of a talk, bad pieces of a talk, what people should think about. And you break it down in every way. Mm. And it's so important because, you know, Jerry Seinfeld has that joke, people are more afraid of public speaking than death. So they'd rather be in the grave than giving the eulogy. So I remember the one time I did a TEDx, San Diego. I've done thousands of public talks, okay, but I'm always scared right beforehand, and particularly TEDx San Diego had thousands of people at it, and I was so scared right beforehand. I honestly started crying and I thought I would just leave because the girl right before me was brilliant. Like she was just so amazing. She had a disability that she had grown up with and she talked about how she had dealt with that disability and how she had overcome it. And then there was supposed to be my talk. And then after my talk was going to be the San Diego Ballet. So without feeling too competitive with the ballet and this girl who was so sweet and so kind and also describing her disability and so on, without feeling competitive with them, I thought like, oh my God, I'm nothing. And I'm like a nothing sandwich bracketed by these two amazing, you know, pieces of bread. And so I literally was going to run out of the hall and just cry.
And somehow you didn't, right?
I didn't.
Well, just about stuck it out. They wouldn't let you go.
They probably wouldn't have let me go. What ends up happening with me in a lot of cases is I get very nervous right up until I hold the mic, and then suddenly a persona develops and I'm able to do it. I don't know what happens. I get like
That's
a
great.
Boost of energy. But I also find that I read your book, and I before your book, when I was doing public speaking, I think I instinctively was doing a lot of those things, and I kind of corrected myself on some of the bad things. But I think with public speaking, the more you know, the more you need to learn, and there's always room for improvement. So before I drill down on all the techniques, I just want to describe to you the experiment I've been doing lately, which has helped my public speaking, which for the past 5 or 6 months, almost every day, I've been doing stand-up comedy to an audience that doesn't know me at all. And it's completely changed my public speaking.
Wow.
Whereas vice versa didn't happen.
Wow. No, that's brave. And I imagine that really would. I mean, people, speaking is so familiar, people definitely forget how much of a miracle it is. I really think it is humanity's superpower that we can, you know, we can do this. Someone can have you talked about a vision. I mean, the currency I see, the core currency that is communicated in a good talk is an idea. You know, that exists in someone's mind. That if you knew what that was neurologically, it would be this really complex pattern, probably involving millions of neuronal connections of some kind. And it is completely amazing that exact pattern can be transferred and amplified and multiplied, basically recreated in, say, 1,000 people out there. I mean, right now, people listening to this, you know, you and I are saying things with a particular intent, and little sound waves are just going into the microphone, you know, down over the internet, whatever, into people's ears, and they have an impact on brains. Your brain, right now, listening to this, your brain will never be the same again because of what you are hearing right now, and to some extent at least, it will change who you are. And the fact that we can do this is really amazing, because there's communication in every species, but what there isn't in any other species is the ability to build something. So you can build concepts that build on top of each other, and they can then be shared and transferred into other brains, and so that we can all build up these worldviews that change our behavior. You know, the fact that someone can invent something for the future, but to achieve that invention, they need other people's help. So what do? Well, they talk about it. They somehow get other people to imagine it. And that imagination creates excitement. And then all those people excited join together and they make that thing possible. I mean, that is an amazing, amazing thing. No one else can do that. And so it's really right at the heart of the reason why humans are humans, why progress of any kind is possible, is the fact that we can share these ideas with each other and get each other excited about them. And both of those things happen in speaking.
Yeah, and just to add to that, and I'm sorry if I interrupt occasionally. I tend to be a serial interrupter. But it reminds me of, it's not just that communicating the ideas, it's communicating them well. Like there's a talent, not a talent, because like anything, there's a little bit of talent and a lot of bit of skill. There's a skill to that communication, to communicate that idea. Like maybe if I have an idea for electricity and I communicate it to you not so well, your brain only gets slightly rewired. And maybe if the next person is an amazing communicator, your brain gets, oh my God, this is the vision for electricity. And then you look back in time and you see Nikola Tesla versus Thomas Edison. Maybe Thomas Edison didn't even have the best solution, but he was an amazing communicator and businessman and you know, all around, almost like a Renaissance man for his times. And he was able to communicate his vision for the future of electricity rather than Tesla. And that's just one example of maybe millions where skill and communication altered the course of the world. And I don't think people realize whether you're an entrepreneur or a writer or a public speaker, this skill is the crux of the matter. It's so important for every doing. You have to communicate what you're going to do.
Absolutely. There are very few things that people can do by themselves. Almost everything that's worthwhile doing has to be done by multiple people with a shared vision. And so, share that vision.
And it's interesting because, like, let's look at the through line, so to speak, of your career. You, of course, started Business 2.0. You were involved in many magazines about the future and technology and computing. And like we discussed earlier, that has sort of transformed now into all the TED Talks and its spawns. But TED, of course, stands for Technology, Entertainment, Design. And I think if you look back to the mid-90s, nobody really knew at that point, was the internet going to be an e-commerce platform? Is this going to be a new medium for entertainment or a new medium for information, all of the above? So all of these things did sort of intersect. And I think you were at the crux of that. And TED now is at the crux of that intersection, because that is still sort of, you know, being born.
Right. And the first TED conference was held in 1984. And that was the year that the Apple Mac was launched. And it was the year that the compact disc was launched.
And it's no mistake that Richard Werman was a graphic designer.
Right. No, indeed. And so right back then, you had both those two inventions were... They integrated technology, entertainment, design in a really sort of powerful way. And so that it seemed to the people at that first conference that there was this amazing sort of synergy between the three fields. And everywhere they looked, they could see more ways where you could build on that. And I first went to TED in 1998, like 14 years later, fell in love with it. By then, it was already starting to branch out beyond those three core fields, because the truth about knowledge is that it's all connected. And we've got this weird paradox in the world where, on the one hand, to get anywhere, you kind of have to pick your subject and kind of go deep into it. But on the other hand, if you don't know the broader context, if you don't know what other people are doing, if you don't know how what you're doing relates to the rest of what's out there, you may miss out on the biggest innovations, the biggest possibilities, and also the biggest way just to explain what you're doing. So there is enormous power in having at least some communication, being across discipline and trying to get people from different fields talking to each other, break down the silos. You know, ideas famously said they don't come out of nothing. They mate with each other. They spark. Multiple ideas come together. They ignite in a brain that is ready, and poof, something brand new comes out. But that only happens if that brain is open to, you know, like a really diverse set of stimuli. And that might mean watching a software engineer followed by a physicist followed by an incredible musician. And that it's in that mix that something suddenly becomes crystal clear. And so I think that was what was so thrilling to me, was that by day three or four of TED, I was having ideas and making connections I never thought would happen, because of that sort of just immersing in what other people were doing, which I wouldn't normally do in a busy job. Like, it's like, I'm not interested in that. Over two or three days of immersion, you find out that you actually, you know, it's really, really mind expanding to get involved in multiple areas.
Well, and I think you see this from the perspective of someone who is at the top of the pyramid there of all these talks. So you've obviously watched me. I don't know if you've watched all the talks, perhaps, but
not all of the TEDx talks.
But many people listening, including myself, have watched so many of the talks, and it's just like you say. And I think this is true in any kind of innovative leap in society. It's all about this mating of ideas, this idea sex that, okay, we're gonna talk about design, but also technology. And now we can create not only new works of art on the internet, but new services on the internet, which, oh, is it an artistic medium? Is it a service medium? Is it a commercial medium? And all of these things happen when you combine disparate ideas, health, technology, education, and so on. I mean, obviously, many people have probably listened to the Sir Ken Robinson, just by the numbers, many people, have listened to the Sir Ken Robinson TED Talk. It's the most popular one, and it's on education. And I love his one anecdote where this girl is what we would now classify as ADHD or ADD or whatever, and schools would instantly give her medication. The teacher or the doctor, whoever, said, no, she's just get her out of this school and put her in dancing school, and she becomes one of the best dancers ever. And it's that kind of creativity and new ways of looking at things that no matter how much data we accumulate as a society and kind of outsource our basic decision-making to, we still need our own creativity to take us to that next level. And I think listening to these talks help us with that.
That's right. And I think creativity is only going to become more important as a human skill. You know,
it might be the only important human skill after a while.
Certainly one of the most important. Maybe there's other unique forms of human empathy and connection, human service to others, whatever. But creativity, that will probably be one of the last things to be truly taken from us by our robotic overlords.
Although it's funny, like on music, there's like David Cope at UC Santa Barbara has software where his software can make music. You can't tell the difference between that and a Mozart piece. And so on some levels, creativity is trying to be mimicked by algorithms. But I think then there's always a next level.
That's right. I'm not, certainly not saying that machines can't be creative, but humans are remarkably sophisticated. It's never a static thing. Like what was yesterday's creativity is not today's creativity. And I think nurturing creativity is going to be one of the thrilling aspects of the next couple of decades. I think we're going to see an explosion of just amazing aesthetic, people will be inventing things, putting things together, remixing in ways that we can't imagine. And I think whatever the machines do, there will be an infinite sort of paint box there for people to get immersed in. So certainly if I was a parent with a kid at school now, nurturing their creative skills would be really a high priority.
And hand in hand with that, as you expressed in the book and as many people have expressed, is developing not just a skill, but really a great skill at communicating and I think public speaking. You have to be able to communicate your idea, your creativity in a clear, as clear a way as possible. And it's more important than ever.
Right. And to be clear, we're not just talking about someone standing on a stage and saying, ladies and gentlemen, let me talk to you. It could be someone standing in front of their iPhone saying,
right,
hello, YouTube. What have I got for you today? And, so there's the art of public speaking is evolving in real time. And in fact, the fact that great things are visible online is really accelerating that art, so that people are getting inspired by how other people are talking and sharing and presenting. And in the years I've been running TED, I've seen the physical art of standing on a stage, public speaking. It's evolving the whole time. What worked 10 years ago may not work the same way now. People have to keep moving it forward.
Right. So I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the art of public speaking and how to develop it. And I want to address slightly what you just said, which is that people don't realize the competition is not just other public speakers. It's Trump's tweets. It's a song. It's a new book by John Grisham. It's the $11 billion Netflix is spending on original content for TV shows. So there's a lot more competition for your attention. And that's part of the reason why public speaking has to evolve. And part of the reason why even though I've done for myself decades of public speaking, I can't stop improving, and I'm always nervous and I'm always thinking, what do I need to do? But let's talk about it. For the art of public speaking, and again, I highly recommend people read your book, but let's just dive into all of the different issues. What do you consider is what's the most important for you when you're going up there to public speak?
The single most important thing is clarity on what you want to say. Like, often people go and they're interested in lots of things, right? At any one moment in time, you're interested in lots of things. And you think, well, I've got so much time, so I'm going to talk about as many things as I can in that time. That's not the right approach.
What was an example of that?
An example of that might be, a scientist coming in and that they've been working on three projects and they try and explain all three, but no one ever really understands any of them because they're all a little bit, you know, they all involve too much background to be able to just summarize. So the trap that so many speakers fall into is called the curse of knowledge, and it's that people forget what it's like not to know something. To know and understand something takes a lot of context. There's a lot of building blocks in your brain underneath the sort of surface idea that you know, the headline. Underneath the headline, there's a lot of context. And you forget often what's down there. You think that if you just give the headline, people will go, okay, I get it. They won't. So the key with the talk is to cut out two-thirds of the things that you think you want to say and focus on what's left. Go in deeper, and that means doing the following. It means early on, you know, giving people a reason to know why it even matters. Why is this an interesting question or problem or topic? And that there's lots of ways that you can do that. You can tell a story about how you got into it. You can just ask the right kinds of provocative questions. But I mean, you have to give people a reason to care about why this thing matters. And then, you know, take people on a journey, on like a detective story almost, of exploring it. You know, is this a way of understanding this? How have people thought about this historically? Why doesn't that obvious way of thinking about this make sense anymore? Describe a couple of dead ends almost. And then give examples about how you have started to think about something. So often people will say, here's my idea. And it doesn't really land. And the reason it doesn't land is because people can't, you know, it's a conceptual thing. To understand it, people need to know concrete things. How does it actually relate in the real world? You know, and
what's an example of that? Like, what's an example? So bridge us between some example, clarity of vision, and right. How it relates in the real world that you appreciate.
Right. So sure. So you know, the psychologist Dan Gilbert came to TED, and he wanted to explain this idea of synthetic happiness, and that how people, even when really bad things happen to them, a few months later weren't that unhappy. And after really good things happened, a few months later weren't that happy. So you could say that and you've explained the idea, but it hasn't landed. And the way he got it to land was to give examples. And he quoted Pete Best from the Beatles saying that not joining the Beatles was the best thing that ever happened to him. And you go, what? And Or he quoted a business executive who'd gone to jail, and how that had actually been the key, his key to a better life. Or he quoted stats on lottery winners and paraplegic people who'd lost the ability to walk, and people who'd won millions of dollars, and a year later they're actually both back at the same levels of happiness. So it's those examples make what he's saying astonishing and real. And then you think, well, then you really want to know, what is the psychological mechanism that is underpinning that? How could that even be? And it's that grounding. And so many speakers make the mistake of just going at the conceptual level. They think that by saying, if something bad to you happens a year later, you'll be just as happy. That doesn't convince you. It's the examples that convince you.
It's the examples. I mean, and it's funny, you break out in your book, you break out the difference between examples and storytelling. But of course, examples are a type of mini stories. So he has kind of the overriding clarity. He wants to explain a complicated concept. So he gives a series of mini examples to trigger your curiosity. And then he's able to dive. Now that you're on the edge of your seats, what's going on? I want to be like Pete Best and be okay with the bad things in my life.
Right.
He's able to then take you to the finish line. Whereas he might have also said, when I was 6 years old, I lost a leg. I mean, he didn't, but
right.
he might have also taken you on a journey, which was the arc of the hero. But I'm just as happy now, according to the MRIs and whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, an example is a story. Those terms are often interchangeable. In the Ken Robinson talk you just talked about, what you remembered from the talk was a story.
Right.
You know, if Ken Robinson had just said, "I'm really worried about the loss of creativity in schools," no one would have remembered the talk. The fact that he made everyone laugh hysterically for 80 minutes and then gave this extraordinarily moving story about Andrew Lloyd Webber's choreographer as a girl, and you know, everyone remembers that story, and it rams home the power of his point that the school system almost had this tragic outcome that this young girl never found her destiny.
Well, it's almost like there's there is sort of a neurology to storytelling. Because if you think about it, and Yuval Harari talks about this in Sapiens, how did we, this sort of wimpy, species in Eastern Africa without any hair and not big teeth and we weren't that large or anything, how did we, you know, conquer the world essentially and spread all over the place, the only species to do so? And his argument is that somehow or other around 70,000 BC, the brain developed the ability to believe in stories. And so then that you could share them generation by generation to communicate ideas that are important, like this area is safe, these people are good, these people are bad because of this God. And that's how we win. So it's built into the brain somehow, this rewarding of a good story.
Yeah, I think it was probably an unintended consequence of inventing fire and controlling fire. And that started like a million years ago. But over hundreds of thousands of years, humans, instead of going to bed as soon as it got dark, had this technology that allowed them to stay up later, scare off wild beasts, stay warm. And they built social bonds. And they, I guess, you know, you can imagine it all, drumming together, dancing together. And then slowly communication and language developed. And it's this miracle that someone could stand up on a fireplace and look at everyone else and start talking. And people's minds started melding and syncing with that person. And I really think it's key to humans' ability to cooperate and so forth. And storytelling was... It's in every culture, and it's the simplest and most potent form of communication, because what that allows, it allows all the listening brains to just imagine the circumstances of the speaker and feel what that speaker was feeling. And so, you know, whatever the story, I was going, you know, through the jungle being pursued by this beast, and then I dodged and found this river and escaped in the river. You can kind of imagine that and picture that. And that story has given you useful information. Next time you're chased, you think, wait, maybe there's a river somewhere I can escape to, you know. So actually,
and it's a safe way to get that information, as opposed to, let's say, many other species have to actually experience a bad thing repeatedly to then avoid it. Someone could listen to, don't drive 160 miles per hour while drunk, because this is what happened to me. I lost both my arms and legs.
That's right.
And now the listener could say, okay, I'll never do that.
Exactly. So you can definitely make a case that storytelling had a literal evolutionary consequence, that we co-evolved with storytelling, that great storytellers and great listeners had an evolutionary advantage. And that is why stories have become more and more important to us, and they consume us in many ways, and they've led to all these other unexpected benefits of being able to share ideas.
You know, it's interesting because you mentioned, I don't remember if you mentioned specifically the fire concept, because that's fascinating, but you did quote, I believe, another TED speaker talking about the difference between what we discuss in the morning versus what we discuss at night. So in the morning, we'll discuss like issues and, I don't know, politics or what's on the morning shows or whatever. And at night, we go into storytelling mode and we dance and it's a little bit more entertainment focused. But again, even things like dancing or performance or storytelling, all of these are safe ways to kind of mimic dangerous things that happen in the jungle, and we are able to resolve that tension in our bodies through this entertaining medium that our brain rewards, and the better storytellers get rewarded in so many different ways. Now it's I mean, it's you can see how they're rewarded.
That's right. And it's a short step from there to dreaming together, planning together. From the point of view of public speaking, what the key thing to remember is that this storytelling is a deeply primal human thing. When you tell a good story, you're tapping into something that's tens of thousands of years old. Use them. I think occasionally speakers are great storytellers, and that's all that they are. And there's like the stories are always entertaining and gripping. I love even more stories that are entertaining and gripping and are told in service of an idea. You know, there's something that you learn from it in the process.
Well, I think if you look at like a movie, so let's just take Schindler's List as an example. I'll take the most extreme example. Gripping story from beginning to end. Has all the characteristics of a great story. And of course, Steven Spielberg's one of the great storytellers of all time. But of course, you learn, the viewer learns many things, and the main characters learn many things during the movie, and the viewers learn many things during the movie. And that makes Schindler's List maybe the best movie of all time.
That's right. But and unfortunately, a lot of speakers make the trap of not doing that. So one of the main reasons we turn down speakers at TED, I would say, is that they want to come and just tell their story, and they've done a few interesting things. They're a good storyteller, but there's no gift in it. It's kind of self-serving, right? It's I'm so interesting on stage, you know. Let me tell you about another cool thing I did, and they're forgetting what I think is the core idea of a great talk, which is it's supposed to be a gift. You know, you're supposed to be giving something to the audience, and you've got this chance for hundreds of people to walk away never quite being the same again. And they will, if that happens, they will always remember you, that you gave them something that they could use in their lives. So telling stories in service of an idea, in service of a gift from you, the speaker, to the audience, I think that's a really important principle for a great talk.
I love the idea that the idea is the gift and the stories are in service of the gift. So can I give you an example and you can tell me if this is an analogy for what you just said?
Sure.
So Ted Williams is one of the, you're not from the US, so I'm still assuming you know who Ted Williams is.
I love his name.
Okay. he's one of the greatest baseball players of all time. He wrote a book called The Science of Hitting. I think he's the only or one of the only baseball players to bat over 400, 40% of his hits made it. And so he wrote a book called The Science of Hitting, which explains how he did it. So, by the way, I'm not a baseball fan at all, but I love that he wrote this book. And he basically describes for this type of pitch, and he draws like an outline, like a box of where the ball could end up hitting. Here's how he's going to swing the bat. And he kind of gives examples and draws pictures. So that's telling an important idea for anybody who wants to be a great baseball player. This is the greatest hitter of all time. He breaks it down like a science. He tells you exactly how he does it. Given this pitch, hit like this. Given this pitch, hit like this. So that's the gift. But stories in service of the gift might be, look, when I was 19, I used to swing at the ball like this, and I'd foul it every time, and the audience would boo. And so finally, I was up all night, and I had my daughter pitching to me, and she was only 4 years old, and she was crying. And I realized she kept throwing it down because she's little, and I realized, oh, I got to hold the bat this way. Then that's the story in service of how he learned each thing.
Yeah, exactly. That would be a great example, great metaphor. And there, you can imagine a great baseball player writing a book that was really just designed to boost their own ego. And they actually didn't want to reveal all their secrets to the world or whatever. And they just wanted people to think how cool they were and how they'd battled the odds and all the rest of it. And actually, they weren't interested in giving away something that someone else could use. So, but in his case, he didn't do that, and that's great. That was a gift.
Yeah, no, just from what the little I know, he loved the science of hitting so much. He would take thousands of pages of notes, and diaries and journals and compiled it into a very slim book, but he wasn't a storyteller. So he did have this incredible gift that he wanted to share humbly. He wasn't a storyteller and was not able to kind of express the story of his love for hitting and why he did this and so on.
Well, in that case, that might also be a tragedy because you need both. Like you need the information there, but you need to present it in a way that is really accessible and that people get and people want to spend time immersed in.
But I love how you just said basically gift minus stories equals tragedy. so let's dive into that a bit because obviously then we don't want tragic things to happen.
We do not.
All of the time people talk about a great story is the arc of the hero. So like Star Wars, Jesus, you know, Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. And the analogy that I've seen many people make, and I kind of agree with this, is that this arc of the hero should not just be in a great book or a religious text or a movie like Star Wars. It needs to even be in a scientific paper. It needs to be in a public talk. It needs to be in a one-line joke. So maybe from your perspective and what you've seen across these thousands of talks and stories that are publicly given, what to you is the arc of the story? What are the parts of a story that make something great that people often forget? Let's stop to take a quick break. We'll be right back. You know, I never thought I was going to wear a suit again. I used to wear a suit when I went on TV news shows and things like that. And then I got rid of all of my suits. But now, Indochino has changed my mind. I'm seeing suits in an entirely new light. Let me tell you why. It's because it actually fits. Most suits go by a generic size chart. Small, regular, large. What's regular anyway? When you put on a suit that's made to measure, something that actually fits your body, it's life-changing. Indochino invited me to their beautiful store. They have a bunch and two in New York City. I went to the one on Broome Street. And they measured my chest for me, my arms and my legs. But thank goodness, I'm not ticklish. I'm a professional. The point is this. Indochino is making it easy to get a perfectly tailored suit at an incredible price. Here's how it works. Visit a showroom or shop online at Indochino.com. Pick your fabric, choose your customizations from lapels to pleats to jacket linings and more. Submit your measurements, place your order, and just wait for it to arrive in just a few weeks. I really recommend if you've never had that experience of wearing a made-to-measure suit, then just consider giving it a try now because the feeling is amazing. It really is different. And this week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $379 at Indochino.com when entering James at checkout. That's 50% off, half off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit, which is a really, really great deal. Plus, shipping is free. That's Indochino.com, promo code James, for any premium suit for just $379 and free shipping. Incredible deal for a suit that will fit you better than anything off the rack ever could, ever would, ever should. What are the parts of a story that make something great that people often forget?
The types of stories that I'm most interested in are stories that are in service of an idea. I mean, the term for that is, or that I use, is parable. And I don't mean that just in the religious sense.
Sure.
That's how it's most often used. But it's a story told where if you pay attention to it, you will learn something from it. And I think, sure, I mean, most, you know, there's most stories, you know, have a protagonist who goes through, faces some kind of challenge, and then it's resolved. I mean, that Ken Robinson story you told was an exact, you know, example of that, of here's a girl, she's suffering at school, nearly a disaster happens, but then she goes to dance school, and there's a sort of triumphant ending.
And that's similar to the examples that Dan Gilbert does as well, because they're like mini stories, again, in service of this higher idea. So in Ken Robinson's case, the revolution in education or what needs to happen. In Gilbert's case, the idea of what is synthesized happiness. And then there's the different example, which is the entire through line. A story goes through the entire through line.
Right. So, I mean, I think to tell a story effectively, you know, that you need to, the context needs to be set up so that people can understand the parable part of it. They can understand why you are telling this story. And often you just, you know, you need to pay attention to which parts are actually necessary. Sometimes when you hear people tell stories, they go on for far too much length about pieces that were only of interest actually to you and your friends and sister and not to the rest of the world, and are not necessary for communicating the idea behind the story.
Hence the need for development of skill of storytelling.
Exactly. Of putting yourself in the audience's shoes. Is this really, like, what's the key way to make this story land so that every part of it is effective? And so it's not, even though stories are the easiest part of a talk to give if you're a speaker, because you don't lose your way. Like, everyone can remember a story that because your brain is reliving a sequence of events, it doesn't forget. You know, like, you go, no one loses that a talk at that moment.
It's true. It's just like, I always forget subtitles, but I'll remember
a story.
The story in the book, in between the page, in between the covers.
Right. It exactly syncs with how our brains are sort of structured. So all that is easy. But people, so where it goes wrong is just that you forget a key piece of context that was actually needed for the story to land, or you just pump in too much detail that just actually isn't needed for the idea that you're really wanting people to focus on.
But if somebody's putting too much detail in, two things are happening. One is they don't realize this is a weakness of theirs, otherwise they wouldn't do it. And the other is they don't know how to eliminate the detail.
Right.
So one way, of course, is with a coach or an accountability partner, but sometimes that's difficult.
You actually just need an honest friend who is roughly represents the type of demographic or whoever's in the audience. And you try every talk, you should try it out on people. It's amazing to me that people do not bother to rehearse talks. You know, musicians rehearse like crazy, athletes practice. A talk is really important. It's more important than most things you do. And people don't rehearse it and don't try it out. And that's because, I think it's because there's social awkwardness in doing it. Just even in giving a practice talk to a friend, there's a little bit of stress.
Yeah, it feels weird, by the way, to talking to one person, like, in a talk.
Yeah, it does. But I feel stressed out doing it. But every time I force myself to do that, to just sit down, whether it's with a few colleagues at work or whatever, it's, okay, here's where I'm at so far. This probably isn't very good yet, but let me try it. You learn so much about, and then, you know, so ask the specific questions. Where did I go on too much? What wasn't clear? Where did you get bored? Is my tone sounding okay? Sometimes when people speak, they kind of go into a oration mode where they suddenly think they have to be grandiose instead of just being conversational. You know, the feeling you want when you're giving a talk is as if you're at dinner with a great set of friends and you're just sharing with them something that you're passionate about. It's that conversational style is what you want.
So it's interesting because, so not only the structure of the story where we kind of initially, where my question was initially going, but really different aspects of the delivery, like the cadence and the rhythm and so on, these are instrumental to the storytelling.
Yes, they are. I think you can think of your voice as punctuation. It's amazing how many different things a voice can do. You know, high and low, slow and fast, pauses, changes of pace, emphasis, and people. You can actually, when you listen to someone's voice, you can intuit what they're feeling. You can tell when someone's uncertain. You can tell when they're really passionate. You can tell when they're teared up.
And actually, you mentioned that in the book, that a very small percentage of telling how someone is feeling is communicated through the words. And much more is communicated through intonation, body language, and so on.
Yes, on what they're feeling, not in terms of content. There's a whole school of public speaking advice, which is done a terrible disservice, which is focused on, is misunderstood as a piece of research that was done in the 60s. And so it tries to say that only a tiny part of communication is through words. It's mostly body language and tone of voice and so forth. And that is dead wrong.
But feeling being such an important part of that communication, at least there's a
that
component.
That is communicated. And absolutely, that is communicated. So yeah, so what you do with your voice while you're speaking certainly matters. And the main thing not to do is to put people to speak. Like, so many people speak, every sentence has the same intonation. And then they have the exact same pause between each sentence, and they go on with the next voice, and it ends the same way again. And when you repeat that 100 times, everyone is asleep because it's hypnotic. Whereas some things in a talk are exciting, some are lightweight, some are storytelling and have a bit of pace to it, you can accelerate a bit. Some really matter. And so you change your voice, and it really helps to do that and to pay attention to that, and not just, it's a trap to think that, you know, you're just reading a speech or something like that. That's an awful waste of one of the key tools of giving a talk.
Well, I think that's obvious, right? So anybody who has read a speech versus gone up against someone who's telling a story realizes right. the difference. But I think even taking it a step further, if you're telling the story and you're acting out, as opposed to telling the story, you act out the roles, like my dad then told me, and then act out, you know, James, you better not do that again. And okay, daddy. Like, see, you naturally laugh like when I do voices. Like,
but be careful with it. Like, you have to be able to pull that off. Like, there's this is something to test against. This is one reason why you need an honest friend, because we've had people come to TED and try and give a talk and put on little accents and all the rest of it, and they think they're God's gift to the public speaking universe, and we're all cringing, and you have to get it right.
Right. So like with anything, there's the skill factor.
There's a skill factor.
And it's interesting to me, though, that given that everything is so primal, how vast and wide, and like you said earlier, ever-changing that skill factor is. Like, you would think after 250,000 years as a species, we'd all probably be in a pretty narrow range of skill on something that's so critically important to our survival as a species. But in fact, we're not at all.
No, indeed. I mean, what our brains notice are things that are different. And so that puts constant pressure on innovating and on finding a way to surprise people.
Do you think that also puts a negative pressure, because you don't want to be different to be kicked out of the tribe? You don't want to be different in a bad way, because then you might get kicked out of the tribe.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it can be scary, and a lot of people therefore want to play it safe. Sure. I definitely would encourage people to be ready to take risks, but I'd also encourage people to test it out in an audience. Don't make your first experiment with, you know, 800 people with your reputation at stake. It's worth the effort to try something out first.
So you know, another thing you mentioned throughout the book, and you allude to here, is part of storytelling is also likability. People kind of have to like the person they see on the stage. They've never seen that person before, perhaps, but you kind of have to, within a few seconds even, get them to like you. And that could be, you know, smiling at them. That could be expressing a vulnerability, or getting them to express it. You give an example where the speaker got them to confess to being stressed in many situations or not. So what are kind of like your tips for like that fast likability?
Yeah, it's maybe not just likability. It's what you have to get to is where the audience wants to go on this journey with you. So they may not like you in the sense that they'd want to, I don't know, date you or have a drink with you, but they want to be intrigued by you, and they you want them to trust you enough to open up their minds and give you a chance to put some of your ideas in there. It's no surprise that people are naturally skeptical about strangers' words. I mean, you know, we've all taught this, right? Like, if we believed everything we heard, our lives would blow up very quickly. And so there's all
my life has blown up very quickly, believing everything that I've heard. It took a long time to stop believing everything I've heard.
Skepticism really matters. And so early on in a talk, you need to be careful not to trigger those responses of shutting down the doors. And the worst thing that happens is someone comes on, their ego on full display, they sound like a blowhard, you can tell that they have an agenda, and chuck, 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 you can kind of hear the audience doors shutting, slamming shut in their brains, and nothing of value will actually be communicated. So early on, if a speaker shows a bit of vulnerability, shows a bit of humanity, shows you why what you're about to hear actually matters, it's going to be interesting. You know, this is a problem I've been thinking about my whole life, and people don't normally know it. So I'm going to open the secret to you. Now if you can make people want to open the door and make them curious, then suddenly they will really pay attention when you say, okay, so it was this thing that got my attention and changed forever how I think about this issue. Can I share it with you? Let me share it with you. So what I say in the book is you can't push knowledge into a brain. You know, it has to be pulled in. And so your first job is to create that desire to pull, you know, that sort of, okay, give me more. I'm here, I'm with you, this is cool. And there's lots of different ways to do it. You know, it's not, some people start with an endearing anecdote of some kind, and, you know, you make people laugh. If you make people laugh, that brings with it an inevitable kind of opening up. But not everyone can do that. So maybe it's sparking the right kind of curiosity. Have you ever wondered why this happened? It's been bugging me forever. Could we think about that together? You know, like spark that curiosity. That may be enough to get people to want to come with you.
You know, it reminds me of, I'll maybe mispronounce his last name, even though he's been on this podcast several times, but Dan Ariely's talk and his books and everything, where he basically, you know, he's experienced massive burns and when he was a teenager, and so he was dealing with the massive pain of whether a nurse should rip off the bandages. Whenever they changed the bandages, they would rip them off either fast or slow, and he wanted to know what was better. And that's kind of how he starts things off, and you're in it with him. You want to know too.
Right, exactly.
And that's extreme vulnerability, because you're also looking at him, and it's not that he's bad looking, but you see that he's experienced this trauma, and you feel for him, and you want to know for him and for yourself too, because you could always picture yourself this happening too.
That's right. So it's a little bit of human bonding at the start of the journey together through your talk. Yeah.
And so part one is kind of that vulnerability, or that bonding, some way of, okay, now I've established this connection to your brain so that the magic trick can begin.
Exactly.
You know, what would you say is step two? And again, by the way, this is all in your book, but it gives me a chance to drill on the master on all of these different ideas.
Well, so let's say that what you're trying to do is to build this complicated pattern called an idea inside someone else's mind. The only way you can possibly do that in a limited time period is to use building blocks that are already in their minds. You can't build the whole thing from scratch. So, you know, you assume that they speak the same language as you, and each word that they know has with it a series of concepts. So the key is to have a sense of where the audience's start point is. So many talks go in and use a piece of jargon or a piece of knowledge that the listener doesn't know what to do with. So I talk about...
What's an example?
Well, so, you know, a software engineer might come in and talk about code branching and whatever. And everyone's going, okay, I'm gone. You have to have a sense of where the audience is, and often this means just testing out a talk. But explanation means creating concepts one step at a time. I mean, in the book I talk again about that the Dan Gilbert talk, Explaining Synthetic Happiness, you know, where he started out by giving this concept of an experience simulator. And people know what a simulator is, what a flight simulator is. And so they can kind of get what an experience simulator is by analogy. And from that was one of the key sort of concepts that he needed to get to explaining synthetic happiness. And it was a series of blocks put together one on top of the other where you kind of get where he's going. In a talk we had about CRISPR, the key explanation for CRISPR, which is, you know, it's a complicated piece of science, it's a really important piece of science because of its implications.
But, can you describe what CRISPR is?
This was the explanation. It is a word processor for gene editing. So you know what a word processor is. That's an existing concept in everyone's mind. If it wasn't, by the way, if no one had ever knew what a computer or a word processor was, the explanation would fail. But if people know what a word processor is and they know what a gene is, then a word processor for gene editing, that tells you, okay, I get it. You can cut and paste genes to make them be whatever you want. That's what CRISPR allows you to do. It actually uses bacteria to cut and paste elements of DNA into different parts. And so it gives you at least an intuitive sense of what CRISPR is and what the power of it is, because you know what the power of a word processor is for writing. So a lot of explanations depend on choosing the right metaphors and making sure that the concepts are introduced in a sort of logical order where, you know, you need one to build up the next. And it's hard for speakers to do because of this curse of knowledge. You know, you forget what it was like not to know what you know. And so certainly if you're trying to explain something difficult, you just need to really pay attention and go through multiple versions trying to say, is every step of this really clear? And we certainly spend a lot of time with speakers trying to encourage them to say, you know, this particular part of what you say is underexplained. We need a little bit more of that. That, by the way, you're going on too much. You know, like it's giving that kind of feedback is it's really hard to do individually.
And you know, how important is it? And again, I'm thinking again the classic arc. How important is it after you? So you've established this bonding. You're kind of like you say, using the building blocks that are already in the audience's heads, so that they're able to kind of build with you. How important is it then to keep bringing back, not necessarily vulnerability, but like, and then I had this problem, and then I had an even more difficult problem, and then they cut off my funding, and I had nowhere to go.
Yeah, I mean, look, every talk is different, and the single biggest message of the book is that there is no formula to public speaking. That's the last thing you would want. Otherwise, life would very quickly get boring. You want 1,000 different approaches to speaking. So that there's just tools. And explanation is a key tool. Storytelling is a key tool. Some talks sure have a story that sort of builds throughout the whole talk. It may just be your own journey of discovery that you take people on. Other talks, not so much. You know, you tell a story and then you move on and explain the idea itself and where it's heading. I mean, there's a thousand different types of talks.
So outside of the storytelling, I get on the stage. I've got my idea. I've got my story, and I'm feeling pretty good about it. And I've got my voice and what I'm going to do with it. How important are things like, you know, moving around the stage, trying to establish eye contact with the audience, maybe even engaging with the audience, which is a little riskier, doing power poses as Amy Cuddy suggests in her famous TED talk. What are other aspects that people should at least keep in mind on a checklist?
I think the power poses were probably for before the talk to sort of, you know, feel... get the
By the way, Monica Lewinsky says in your book, she says to you that she did power poses with Amy Cuddy coaching her on them.
That's right, before the talk. You know, it's work off some of the adrenaline and it's a good technique for fighting nerves. Let's say on stage, there's no single right answer. I mean, the one trait that you sometimes see speakers do that you wish they wouldn't is sort of shift from side to side rhythmically. They shift from one leg to the other, or they step forward, they step back, they step forward, they step back. It's a sort of, they're fighting nerves there. There's sort of a little physical tension in their body, and they're, without knowing it, they're sort of fighting that. And it that sort of repetitive movement feels a bit hypnotic. So when you see that, the advice is just, hey, just breathe a bit, just stay still, you know, let your feet be still on the stage. Move your upper body, sure, to express, but the simplest way to give a talk is just to have the lower part of your body still and anchored, you know, on the stage, and then your upper body is flexible and mobile. You can move around, you look at different people, but it's also other people are comfortable walking. If you walk, that's great. It makes sense from time to time just to stop for a moment for the key points, and they will actually have added emphasis that way. Eye contact absolutely is important. This is like one of the fundamentals of human-to-human communication. Our eyes do 1,000 things when we look at another human. You know, they are our empathy builders. They are our bullshit detectors. We see what someone is feeling, and you can just tell so much by looking at someone. And so if you are not looking at individual members of the audience, but kind of giving the talk with your eyes sort of rolled up into your head, or looking out over the some sort of, you know, middle space above the audience's heads, or looking down into your notes the whole time, that's disconnecting. That's really missing the chance for the talk to land.
This is a bit tactical, but sometimes the lights are such that you can't really see the eyes of the audience.
That's a terrible mistake by event organizers. We've sometimes done that. Mm-hmm. You know, the lighting designer has lights at the back and they want to light up your face for the video camera, and so it's dazzling. That's just a terrible way to do it, because speaker audience connection really matters. And so I think it's okay if you're in that circumstance. I mean, it's something to talk about before with an event organizer. It's okay to ask for house lights to be brought up a bit so that you can see people. But better yet, you know, try and test out what it's going to feel like on stage before you actually give the talk. But I think giving one sentence to someone, when you do that, everyone else in the room can see that you're doing that. They can see that you're making human eye contact. Even if you're not making it with someone else, they can see that you're connecting with someone. Mm. And
that's actually an interesting little technique.
Yeah, it is. And the trap, the reason why a lot of people struggle with this is because they don't know their talk adequately well. They're spending too much of their cognitive load trying to remember a talk. And so a talk wants to feel like it is being delivered in the moment. That people want to feel like you are thinking it through and that you're saying what you mean in the moment with passion, not that you're reciting. So if you're going to remember a talk, you have to really know it so well that you're not struggling to remember it. And that way you can look around at someone and just smile at them and say in the moment, you know, this is why I'm passionate about this one point right now.
Would you go one step further, which is kind of engage and ask a question? Like, do you see what I'm saying? Or
you can do that. You can do that. It's
a bit riskier.
Yeah, it's riskier, and with a recorded talk, it may not work. But I actually think a lot of great speakers do that and get energy from the audience that way.
I mean, I got an extreme example is like Tony Robbins certainly gets.
I was going to say,
yeah, he's been on the podcast. He has so much energy. He was right at in this studio. We actually made an animation about it. He had so much energy, like the table and the microphones were shaking. So the audio engineer had to come in and say, "Hey, love the passion, but you can't hear everything."
So, you know, he came to TED and gave a talk, and it was actually one of the first six that we posted. And I would say the first 5 or 6 minutes of the talk, you know, were okay. You know, they were fast. They were sort of fast moving. You know, he was trying out. He doesn't usually do that much with slides and stuff. There were sort of slides going. It was his TED thing. It wasn't spectacular. It was sort of okay. And then, you know, he started asking the audience questions, and he asked, you know, a question about what has been an impediment in your life. And Al Gore, who's sitting in the second row, goes, "The Supreme Court." And so he says, yeah, that was great. That was a great line. And then he comes back to him and says, but you know what? He starts talking about the power of emotion. He said, if you'd shown half the emotion you showed yesterday when you spoke, you would have won that damn election. And the whole room erupted. And he was saying, thank you for your energy to Al Gore. And so that interchange transformed that talk. And from the rest of the talk, he was on fire. And so, yeah, he...
What did you see as different for the rest of the talk? Like, is it how people perceived him or did he actually act differently?
He was no longer going through his shtick. He was communicating from what he really meant. And he's connecting
to something a little deeper as opposed to the stopping at the prepared moments.
Yeah, I think because he had seen where the audience was, he was just in a different place. I mean, he's definitely, you know, on a different level to most of us. There are very few speakers who can do what he can do. I certainly can't.
And he's a professional speaker.
Yeah, no, he's professional. And so he feels where an audience is and can tap into it. But that was certainly very cool to see.
Yeah. No, I remember that interaction, actually. It's funny because it's funny what you remember of talks, because you watch like 1,000 talks, obviously you don't remember every talk. I remember the Tony Robbins talk, and I specifically remember the Al Gore interaction. I don't really remember the before and after. but it does bring up the question of a lot of people in a lot of situations obviously work well with slides. And I used to give a lot of talks with slides. I'm sort of the belief now I don't like slides at all. Even though this is not a criticism of anybody else. A lot of people are very successful with them. Steve Jobs certainly uses them. Tony Robbins uses them. But it feels to me like the brain is multitasking when the speaker uses slides. Like the listener has to multitask looking at the slides and the speaker.
Sometimes. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely a trap there. There's no rule on this. It's absolutely possible for certain people in certain circumstances to give a talk with no slides and be riveting and to, you know, where it would have been a tragedy if they were to put something up. But many other talks need visuals to really explain. There's just different types of communication. And the great thing about a talk is you can use both visual communication and verbal communication. And the key is to plan it and not have, like, what doesn't work is to have a really complex slide up while you're then trying to give a complex explanation that doesn't completely relate to what's on the slide and so forth. We encourage people to try and do like one main idea on a slide that you want to communicate not do the thing that some scientists do and have like sort of four images all on one slide, as if we were still in an era where, you know, each extra slide cost another $5 or something like that. You know, you can just have four slides, not one, with four images. And so making the visuals relate to what you're saying in a way that does not create cognitive overload matters. But some talks are completely made by their visuals. And it just depends what you're trying to communicate. Like if you're a visual artist or a designer or so forth, you're showing your work, maybe the single most important part of the talk. In fact, for some artists and designers, you actually don't want to even think of it as a talk. You want to think of it as you're showing your work.
Right.
And your words are just there in the service of the images. Your words are like whispered captions and context setting. And it's not, in my next work, I sought out to define the context of da-da-da-da-da. It's like, no, just show us why this matters, why you care about it. Show us the work. Be silent. Let people imagine that this is the best museum or exhibition hall you've ever brought an audience into and that you've owned their attention and let them see it. So there's every case. And there are talks that almost you want a blizzard of slides of just boom, 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 moving quickly.
I actually like that. I've seen, I think the book Slideology discusses that as a style of slide use of like doing a 30-minute talk with 200 slides. So I've tried that and it actually is fun. Like I like doing that because then again, people can't focus on the slides. They have to listen to you and it's part of the performance almost is to have all these slides in there. Yeah. Or I like, when I used to use slides, just having like one concept per slide. So it's not, there's no kind of overload.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I also like, and you've said it several times, show us why this matters. It seems like the speaker should throughout the talk is what you're saying is constantly ask themselves, show us, am I showing them why it matters to me? Like that is going to be key.
I think that's right. One of Monica Lewinsky's nerve controlling techniques was just to write on her script in big letters, this matters. And I think that's actually true. It's like you come out, this ultimately isn't about you. You're here in the service of something bigger than you are, and you're passionate about it, and you have this opportunity to share this thing. So, what you're saying, it matters. Why it matters to you absolutely needs to come out. Why it should matter to anyone needs to come out.
Well, and I like that you mentioned she had two mantras. This matters and I got this.
Right, right.
So to kind of say if she ever gets nervous in the middle, I guess the idea is to remind herself that she's predetermined that she has this and she just needs a reminder of it.
Yes.
And I like that because it reminds me, I used to do CNBC spots about financial news. And I would always get really nervous right beforehand. The lights turn off if you're in a studio and you're about to go on. And I would always kind of repeat to myself, okay, I'm just surrendering here. I want to be good for everybody listening. And I'm just going to surrender that I know what is good for people to hear. I don't know if I did say anything good or not, but that was what I would say to myself. So
I think that's good.
That surrendering kind of sort of outsources to a past version of myself in a weird way, the confidence that I'm about to need.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. I mean, look, everyone has a different way into this. There's no one solution. But for anyone nervous should know that if you're nervous, you are not as nervous as Monica Lewinsky was coming to TED. Stakes were pretty high for her on that. And she absolutely smacked it out of the park.
She was a baseball match.
Well, she might say that. It was a spectacular talk. And I don't know how many, I think more than 10 million people have seen it now. And it's probably changed some of the culture on the internet, not enough yet. But we were very, very, very amazed and impressed to see how she turned abject fear into an absolutely brilliant talk.
So final thing, which is let's just touch on the conclusion of the talk. So here's where the magic trick has already sort of happened, but maybe the audience isn't 100% aware that it's happened. The magician's already done all the kind of finger work he needs to do, but the reveal hasn't necessarily been cemented in the brains. What are some tips you would give for concluding or a checklist or things to think about?
I mean, I think in the book I give lots of ways to end a talk, lots of ways you really shouldn't end a talk. And
negative examples are great all throughout.
And see, it's like people, I mean, one of the most annoying things is people just drifting on and on, not knowing how to end it. You get multiple false endings where people just say, and so it really has been wonderful being here today. And if, by the way, that, so just to emphasize this other point, and oh, that was so good. And by the way, thank you. What you said, they just go on and on. It's like, end the talk already. And it starts to suck away from the impact of it. Sometimes people never end with just like an emphatic, satisfying sort of final sentence. They go, and so that pretty much sums up, what I was thinking about this. And that, what a waste. You've just spent, maybe days preparing a talk and, the last half hour giving it, and that's your best shot at ending, because people remember endings, and there's no way that anyone's going to really burst into applause at that moment or whatever.
But it's very important. So, there's a recency cognitive bias. People are going to remember exactly. The end. And they're going to actually remember, even if your entire talk was bad, but your end was good, they're going to remember you as giving a good talk if your end is good.
They may well. And then the other thing that people do is, you know, they spend the last 5 minutes thanking all of their colleagues and all the rest of it, which is also exhausting. Yes, you should honor them, but more important is to honor the audience. And that is not honoring the audience to do that. That is boring the audience. We don't know those people. So I think you know, it depends on what the talk is. Like a talk that is presenting, like sharing a new piece of work that you have, something you've discovered or thought about, a natural way to end is to share what this means. So what could this lead to? Well, here are three things it could lead to. And if that happens, this will be the most exciting thing that's happened in my life. Or, you know, what it, like just, you, so that, so there's the implications of the work. Then there could be a call to action from people. If I have persuaded you that this matters, this is what I urge you to do tomorrow. Do this tomorrow. Set out what that thing is. So there's the call to action. There might be the next big unanswered question, although that may feel a little open. Sometimes speakers will give themselves a challenge. I'm here today telling you that I'm going to do this X. We had Bill Stone, who was a cave explorer, who came at the end of his talk and he pledged that he was going to take a team of explorers to the moon, you know, and he wanted to lead that team and he was inviting people and it was just a great triumphant.
That is a great way to end.
Anyway, the point is, it's think about your ending. Like if you are going to remember any part of the talk, know the opening and know the ending. The last three or four sentences, know them. Everyone can remember that. And because that is what will give it impact.
I also like what you just said, though, about Bill Stone, because that gives a visual image as well.
Right.
So giving a visual image gives more excuses for people to remember what he just said.
Yes.
This unique thing of like a bunch of people, maybe me, exploring a cave on the moon.
Right.
So like, I just can't even, you have to work to picture it, but everyone's going to, and then they'll remember, it gets stored back in more neurons, you know.
Indeed.
First off, thank you so much for coming and doing this podcast. Like, public speaking is such, and communication in general is such an important part of my life. It's just been a pleasure to ask you questions about it. I highly recommend your book. Tell me the subtitle again, because I always forget. TED Talks, The Effective Guide to Giving a Great TED Talk or something.
Something like that. It doesn't matter.
Chris Anderson writes the key book on public speaking, which I can't remember the title of, but I have effectively remembered all the content, right? I brought up tons of examples.
You've remembered, you've asked great questions. We've there's actually no need for anyone to buy the book now. You know, you've heard.
No. I'll tell you why there's a need to buy the book. I'll tell you why there's an important reason to buy the book. I did not bring up the negative examples. So you gave many, here's four bad ways to give a talk. And by the way, one of them I so 100% agree with, because I'm seeing it in kind of the book publishing culture now on Overdrive, which is the inspirational talk.
Oh,
like
yeah.
The pseudo inspirational book is hitting like every genre of inspiration, from self-help to business. I hate it in a book. I hate it in a talk. And you think to yourself, well, what about I Have a Dream? No, that's not what Martin Luther King was doing.
Yeah, inspiration is one of the most extraordinary things that there is. And I love the fact that people can be deeply inspired by a talk. But speakers whose goal is inspiration kind of make you want to throw up.
Yeah, and the fact that there's an industry around it.
You don't inspire people by trying to be inspiring. You inspire people by being authentic, by doing something extraordinary, by being courageous, by being humble. It's our biggest nausea at TED is being pitched by people who think they're going to inspire like some other TED speaker inspires, and we can't bear it, and we say no to those people more. So if you love the idea of standing, striding the stage and inspiring a million people, stop that for a bit, go in and do something amazing with your life, and then just come and tell us about that.
I like, go, okay, call to action, call to action within the year, go out and do something amazing with your life. Doesn't even really matter what it is. You could be, yeah. I'm going to be a garbage man for the next 30 days and then go to my job in a hedge fund and talk about the difference.
Right.
And then give a talk about it. And by the way, we didn't cover a lot of the things in your book. So still get Chris Anderson's book. And before you give the talk about being the difference between a garbage man and a hedge fund manager. And that really should have been my conclusion, but I'm going to keep going for one more second. If I want to do a TEDx, not speak, but if I want to throw a TEDx, what should I do?
Yeah, so just Google TEDx application and it'll take you straight to the right page on our website, which explains how you apply for a TEDx license. I mean, it's a process, you know, that you need to, it's about doing an event in a specific location, you know, around a specific theme. We probably approve about a third of the licenses of the applications that come in, but we approve a lot. There's 3,500 of these every year, and we welcome people wanting to do this. It's a huge endeavor, so don't do it lightly.
Call to action.
Call to action. Thank you, James.
Well, thanks,
thank
Chris.
You. That was a lot of fun. Thank you. Bye.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network at jamesaltucher.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Hey, thanks for listening. Listen, I have a big favor to ask you, and it will only take 30 seconds or less, and it would mean a huge amount to me. If you like this podcast, please let me know. Please let the team I work with know. Please let my guests know. And you can do this easily by subscribing to the podcast. Probably the biggest favor you could do for me right now, and it's really simple. Just go to iTunes, search for The James Altucher Show, and click subscribe. Again, it will only take you 30 seconds or less, and if you subscribe now, it will really help me out a lot. Thanks again.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches, but there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.